wonder, by taking the child and burying it? I curse Colonel Jol for all the trouble he has brought me, and for the shame, too. Then, in the middle of the night, he is back. Bugle calls from the ramparts break into my sleep. The barracks hall erupts in uproar as the soldiers go scrambling for their weapons. My head is confused. I am slow in dressing. By the time I emerge onto the square, the column is already passing through the gates, some of the men riding, some leading their mounts. I stand back while the onlookers crowd around, touching and embracing the soldiers, laughing with excitement. "All safe!" someone shouts. Until coming up in the middle of the column, I see what I have been dreading. The black carriage. Then the shuffling group of prisoners roped together, neck to neck. Shapeless figures in their sheepskin coats under the silver moonlight. Then, behind them, the last of the soldiers leading the carts and pack horses. As more and more people come running up, some with flaming torches, and the babel mounts, I turn my back on the colonel's triumph and make my way back to my rooms. This is the point at which I begin to see the disadvantages of living, as I have chosen to do, in the rambling apartment over the storerooms and kitchen, intended for the military commandant we have not had for years, rather than in the attractive villa with geraniums in the windows, which falls to the lot of the civil magistrate. I would like to be able to stop my ears to the noises coming from the yard below, which has now, it appears, become permanently a prison yard. I feel old and tired. I want to sleep. I sleep whenever I can nowadays. And when I wake up, wake reluctantly. Sleep is no longer a healing bath, a recuperation of vital forces, but an oblivion, a nightly brush with annihilation. Living in the apartment has become bad for me, I think. But not only that. If I lived in the magistrate's villa on the quietest street in town, holding sittings of the court on Mondays and Thursdays, going hunting every morning, occupying my evenings in the classics, closing my ears to the activities of this upstart policeman. If I resolved to ride out the bad times, keeping my own counsel, I might cease to feel like a man who, in the grip of the undertow, gives up the fight, stops swimming, and turns his face towards the open sea and death. But it is the knowledge of how contingent my unease is, how dependent on a baby that wails beneath my window one day and does not wail the next, that brings the worst shame to me, the greatest indifference to annihilation. I know somewhat too much. And from this knowledge, once one has been infected, there seems to be no recovering. I ought never to have taken my lantern to see what was going on in the hut by the granary. On the other hand, there was no way, once I had picked up the lantern, for me to put it down again. The knot loops in upon itself. I cannot find the end. All the next day, the colonel spends sleeping in his room at the inn, and the staff have to tiptoe about their duties. I try to pay no attention to the new batch of prisoners in the yard. It is a pity that all the doors of the barracks block, as well as the stairway leading up to my apartment, open onto the yard. I hurry out in the early morning light, occupy myself all day with municipal rents, dine in the evening with friends. On the way home, I meet the young lieutenant who accompanied Colonel Jol into the desert and congratulate him on his safe return. "But why did you not explain to the colonel that the fishing people could not possibly help him in his inquiries?" He looks embarrassed. "I spoke to him," he tells me. "But all he said was, 'Prisoners are prisoners.' I decided it was not my place to argue with him." The next day, the colonel begins his interrogations. Once I thought him lazy, little more than a bureaucrat with vicious tastes. Now I see how mistaken I was. In his quest for the truth, he is tireless. The questioning starts in the early morning, and is still going on when I return after dark. He has enlisted the aid of a hunter who has shot pigs up and down the river all his life, and knows 100 words of the fisherfolk's language. One by one, the fisherfolk are taken into the room where the colonel has established himself, to be asked whether they have seen movements of strange horsemen. Even the child is questioned. "Have strangers visited your father during the night?" I guess, of course, at what passes in that room, at the fear, the bewilderment, the abasement. The prisoners are returned not to the yard, but to the main barracks hall. The soldiers have been turned out, quartered on the town. I sit in my rooms with the windows shut, in the stifling warmth of a windless evening, trying to read, straining my ears to hear or not to hear sounds of violence. Finally, at midnight, the interrogations cease. There is no more banging of doors or tramping of feet. The yard is silent in the moonlight, and I am at liberty to sleep. The joy has gone from my life. I spend the day playing with lists and numbers, stretching petty tasks to fill the hours. In the evening, I eat at the inn. Then, reluctant to go home, make my way upstairs to the warren of cubicles and partitioned rooms where the ostlers sleep, and the girls entertain men friends. I sleep like a dead man. When I wake up in the thin early morning light, the girl is lying curled up on the floor. I touch her arm. "Why are you sleeping there?" She smiles back.
"It is all right. I am quite comfortable."
That is true. Lying on the soft sheepskin rug, she stretches and yawns, her neat little body not even filling it.
"You were tossing in your sleep. You told me to go away. So I decided I would sleep better here."
"I told you to go away?"
"Yes, in your sleep. Don't be upset."
She climbs into bed beside me. I embrace her with gratitude, without desire. "I would like to sleep here again tonight," I say. She nuzzles my chest. It occurs to me that whatever I want to say to her will be heard with sympathy, with kindness. But what can I possibly say? Terrible things go on in the night while you and I are asleep. The jackal rips out the hare's bowels, but the world rolls on. Another day and another night I spend away from the empire of pain. I fall asleep in the girl's arms. In the morning she is again lying on the floor. She laughs at my dismay.
"You pushed me out with your hands and feet. Please, don't get upset. We cannot help our dreams or what we do in our sleep."
I groan and turn my face away. I have known her a year, visiting her sometimes twice a week in this room. I feel a quiet affection for her, which is perhaps the best that can be hoped for between an aging man and a girl of 20. Better than a possessive passion, certainly. I have played with the idea of asking her to live with me. I try to remember by what nightmare I am possessed when I push her away, but fail. "If I ever do it again, you must promise to wake me," I tell her. Then in my office at the courthouse, a visitor is announced. Colonel Joll, wearing his dark eye shades indoors, enters and sits down opposite me. I offer him tea, surprised at how steady my hand is. "He is leaving," he says. Should I try to conceal my joy? He sips his tea, sitting carefully upright, inspecting the room. The shelves upon shelves of papers bundled together and tied with ribbon. The record of decades of humdrum administration. the small bookcase of legal texts, the cluttered desk. He has completed his inquiries for the time being, he says, and is in a hurry to return to the capital and make his report. He has an air of sternly controlled triumph. I nod my understanding. Anything that I can do to facilitate your journey, I say. There is a pause. Then into the silence, like a pebble into a pool, I drop my question. And your inquiries, Colonel? Among the nomad peoples and the aboriginals? Have they been as successful as you wished? He places his fingers together tip to tip before he answers. I have the feeling that he knows how much his affectations irritate me. Yes, Magistrate, I can say that we have had some success, particularly when you consider that similar investigations are being carried out elsewhere along the frontier, in a coordinated fashion. That is good. And can you tell us whether we have anything to fear? Can we rest securely at night? The corner of his mouth crinkles in a little smile. Then he stands up, bows, turns, and leaves. Early next morning he departs accompanied by his small escort, taking the long east road back to the capital. Throughout a trying period, he and I have managed to behave towards each other like civilized people. All my life I have believed in civilized behavior. On this occasion, however, I cannot deny it. The memory leaves me sick with myself. My first action is to visit the prisoners. I unlock the barracks hall, which has been their jail, my senses already revolting at the sickly smell of sweat and ordure, and throw the doors wide open. Get them out of there! I shout at the half-dressed soldiers who stand about watching me as they eat their porridge. From the gloom inside, the prisoners stare apathetically back. Go in there and clean up that room, I shout. I want everything cleaned up, soap and water. I want everything as it was before. The soldiers hurry to obey. But why is my anger directed at them, they must be asking. Into the daylight emerge the prisoners, blinking, shielding their eyes. One of the women has to be helped. She shakes all the time like an old person, though she is young. There are some too sick to stand up. I last saw them 5 days ago, if I can claim ever to have seen them, if I ever did more than pass my gaze over their surface absently, with reluctance. What they have undergone in these 5 days, I do not know. Now, herded by their guards, they stand in a hopeless little knot in the corner of the yard. Nomads and fisherfolk together, sick, famished, damaged, terrified. It would be best if this obscure chapter in the history of the world were terminated at once, if these ugly people were obliterated from the face of the earth and we swore to make a new start, to run an empire in which there would be no more injustice, no more pain. It would cost little to march them out into the desert, having put a meal in them first, perhaps, to make the march possible, to have them dig with their last strength a pit large enough for all of them to lie in, or even to dig it for them, and leaving them buried there forever and forever to come back to the walled town full of new intentions, new resolutions. But that will not be my way. The new men of empire are the ones who believe in fresh starts, new chapters, clean pages. I struggle on with the old story, hoping that before it is finished, it will reveal to me why it was that I thought it worth the trouble. Thus it is that administration of law and order in these parts having today passed back to me, I order that the prisoners be fed, that the doctor be called in to do what he can, that the barracks return to being a barracks, that arrangements be made to restore the prisoners to their former lives as soon as possible, as far as possible. 2. She kneels in the shade of the barracks wall, a few yards from the gate, muffled in a coat too large for her, a fur cap open before her on the ground. She has the straight black eyebrows, the glossy black hair of the barbarians. What is a barbarian woman doing in town begging? There are no more than a few pennies in the cap. Twice more during the day I pass her. Each time she gives me a strange regard, staring straight ahead of her until I am near, then very slowly turning her head away from me. The second time I drop a coin into the cap. "It is cold and late to be outdoors," I say. She nods. The sun is setting behind a strip of black cloud. The wind from the north already carries a hint of snow. The square is empty. I pass on. The next day she is not there. I speak to the gatekeeper. "There was a woman sitting over there all of yesterday, begging. Where does she come from?" "The woman is blind," he replies. "She is one of the barbarians the colonel brought in. She was left behind." A few days later I see her crossing the square, walking slowly and awkwardly with two sticks, the sheepskin coat trailing behind her in the dust. I give orders. She is brought to my rooms, where she stands before me propped on her sticks. "Take off your cap," I say. The soldier who has brought her in lifts off the cap. It is the same girl, the same black hair cut in a fringe across the forehead, the same broad mouth, the black eyes that look through and past me. "They tell me you are blind."
"I can see," she says.
Her eyes move from my face and settle somewhere behind me to my right. "Where do you come from?" Without thinking, I cast a glance over my shoulder. She is staring at nothing but empty wall. Her gaze has grown rigid. Already knowing the answer, I repeat my question. She meets it with silence. I dismiss the soldier. We are alone. "I know who you are," I say. "Will you please sit?" I take her sticks and help to seat her on a stool. Under the coat, she wears wide linen drawers tucked into heavy-soled boots. She smells of smoke, of stale clothing, of fish. Her hands are horny. "Do you make a living by begging?" I ask. "You know you are not supposed to be in town. We could expel you at any time and send you back to your people." She sits staring eerily ahead of her. "Look at me," I say.
"I am looking. This is how I look."
I wave a hand in front of her eyes. She blinks. I bring my face closer and stare into her eyes. She wheels her gaze from the wall onto me. The black irises are set off by milky whites as clear as a child's. I touch her cheek. She starts. "I asked how you make a living." She shrugs.
"I do washing."
"Where do you live?"
"I live."
"We do not permit vagrants in the town. Winter is almost here. You must have somewhere to live. Otherwise, you must go back to your own people." She sits obdurately. I know I am beating about the bush. "I can offer you work. I need someone to keep these rooms tidy, to see to my laundry. The woman who does it at present is not satisfactory." She understands what I am offering. She sits very stiff, her hands in her lap. "Are you alone? Please answer."
"Yes."
Her voice comes in a whisper. She clears her throat.
"Yes."
"I have offered that you should come and work here. You cannot beg in the streets. I cannot permit that. Also, you must have a place of abode. If you work here, you can share the cook's room.
You do not understand. You do not want someone like me.
She gropes for her sticks. I know that she cannot see.
I am.
She holds up her forefinger, grips it, twists it. I have no idea what the gesture means.
Can I go?
She makes her own way to the head of the stairs, then has to wait for me to help her down. A day passes. I stare out over the square where the wind chases flurries of dust. Two little boys are playing with a hoop. They bowl it into the wind. It rolls forward, slows, teeters, rides back, falls. The boys lift their faces and run after it, the hair whipped back from their clean brows. I find the girl and stand before her. She sits with her back against the trunk of one of the great walnut trees. It is hard to see whether she is even awake. Come, I say, and touch her shoulder. She shakes her head. Come, I say. Everyone is indoors. I beat the dust from her cap and hand it to her, help her to her feet, walk slowly beside her across the square, empty now save for the gatekeeper who shades his eyes to stare at us. The fire is lit. I draw the curtains, light the lamp. She refuses the stool, but yields up her sticks and kneels in the center of the carpet. This is not what you think it is, I say. The words come reluctantly. Can I really be about to excuse myself? Her lips are clenched shut. Her ears, too, no doubt. She wants nothing of old men and their bleating consciences. I prowl around her, talking about our vagrancy ordinances, sick at myself. Her skin begins to glow in the warmth of the closed room. She tugs at her coat, opens her throat to the fire. The distance between myself and her torturers, I realize, is negligible. I shudder. Show me your feet, I say, in the new, thick voice that seems to be mine. Show me what they have done to your feet. She neither helps nor hinders me. I work at the thongs and eyelets of the coat, throw it open, pull the boots off. They are a man's boots, far too large for her. Inside them, her feet are swaddled, shapeless. Let me see, I say. She begins to unwrap the dirty bandages. I leave the room, go downstairs to the kitchen, come back with a basin and a pitcher of warm water. She sits waiting on the carpet, her feet bare. They are broad, the toes stubby, the nails crusted with dirt. She runs a finger across the outside of her ankle.
That is where it was broken. The other one, too.
She leans back on her hands and stretches her legs. Does it hurt? I say. I pass my finger along the line, feeling nothing.
Not anymore. It has healed. But perhaps when the cold comes.
You should sit, I say. I help her off with the coat, seat her on the stool, pour the water into the basin, and begin to wash her feet. For a while, her legs remain tense, then they relax. I wash slowly, working up a lather, gripping her firm-fleshed calves, manipulating the bones and tendons of her feet, running my fingers between her toes. I change my position to kneel not in front of her but beside her, so that, holding a leg between elbow and side, I can caress the foot with both hands. I lose myself in the rhythm of what I am doing. I lose awareness of the girl herself. There is a space of time which is blank to me. Perhaps I am not even present. When I come to, my fingers have slackened. The foot rests in the basin. My head droops. I dry the right foot, shuffle to the other side, lift the leg of the wide drawers above her knee, and, fighting against drowsiness, begin to wash the left foot. "Sometimes this room gets very hot," I say. The pressure of her leg against my side does not lessen. I go on. "I will find clean bandages for your feet," I say, "but not now." I push the basin aside and dry the foot. I am aware of the girl struggling to stand up, but now I think she must take care of herself. My eyes close. It becomes an intense pleasure to keep them closed, to savor the blissful giddiness. I stretch out on the carpet. In an instant, I am asleep. In the middle of the night, I wake up cold and stiff. The fire is out. The girl is gone. I watch her eat. She eats like a blind person, gazing into the distance, working by touch. She has a good appetite, the appetite of a robust young countrywoman. "I don't believe you can see," I say.
"Yes, I can see. When I look straight, there is nothing. There is..."
She rubs the air in front of her like someone cleaning a window. "A blur," I say.
"There is a blur, but I can see out of the sides of my eyes. The left eye is better than the right. How could I find my way if I didn't see?"
"Did they do it to you?"
"Yes."
"What did they do?" She shrugs and is silent. Her plate is empty. I dish up more of the bean stew she seems to like so much. She eats too fast, belches behind a cupped hand, smiles.
"Beans make you fart," she says.
The room is warm. Her coat hangs in a corner with the boots below it. She wears only the white smock and drawers. When she does not look at me, I am a gray form moving about unpredictably on the periphery of her vision. When she looks at me, I am a blur, a voice, a smell, a center of energy that one day falls asleep washing her feet, and the next day feeds her bean stew, and the next day she does not know. I seat her, fill the basin, roll the drawers above her knees. Now that the two feet are together in the water, I can see that the left is turned further inward than the right, that when she stands, she must stand on the outer edges of her feet. Her ankles are large, puffy, shapeless, the skin scarred purple. I begin to wash her. She raises her feet for me in turn. I knead and massage the lax toes through the soft, milky soap. Soon my eyes close, my head droops. It is rapture of a kind. When I have washed her feet, I begin to wash her legs. For this, she has to stand in the basin and lean on my shoulder. My hands run up and down her legs from ankle to knee, back and forth, squeezing, stroking, molding. Her legs are short and sturdy, her calves strong. Sometimes my fingers run behind her knees, tracing the tendons, pressing into the hollows between them. Light as feathers, they stray up the backs of her thighs. I help her to the bed and dry her with a warm towel. I begin to pare and clean her toenails, but already waves of sleepiness are running over me. I catch my head drooping, my body falling forward in a stupor. Carefully, I put the scissors aside. Then, fully clothed, I lay myself down head to foot beside her. I fold her legs together in my arms, cradle my head on them, and in an instant, am asleep. I wake up in the dark. The lamp is out. There is a smell of burnt wick. I get up and open the curtains. The girl lies huddled asleep, her knees drawn up to her chest. When I touch her, she groans and huddles tighter.
"You are getting cold," I say,
but she hears nothing. I spread a blanket over her and a second blanket. First comes the ritual of the washing, for which she is now naked. I wash her feet as before, her legs, her buttocks. My soapy hand travels between her thighs, incuriously, I find. She raises her arms while I wash her armpits. I wash her belly, her breasts. I push her hair aside and wash her neck, her throat. She is patient. I rinse and dry her. She lies on the bed and I rub her body with almond oil. I close my eyes and lose myself in the rhythm of the rubbing, while the fire, piled high, roars in the grate. I feel no desire to enter this stocky little body, glistening by now in the firelight. It is a week since words have passed between us. I feed her, shelter her, use her body, if that is what I am doing, in this foreign way. There used to be moments when she stiffened at certain intimacies, but now her body yields when I nuzzle my face into her belly or clasp her feet between my thighs. She yields to everything. Sometimes she slips off into sleep before I am finished. She sleeps as intensely as a child. As for me, under her blind gaze in the close warmth of the room, I can undress without embarrassment, baring my thin shanks, my slack genitals, my paunch, my flabby old man's breasts, the turkey skin of my throat. I find myself moving about unthinkingly in this nakedness, sometimes staying to bask in the fire after the girl has gone to sleep, or sitting in a chair reading. But more often in the very act of caressing her, I am overcome with sleep as if poleaxed, fall into oblivion sprawled upon her body, and wake an hour or two later, dizzy, confused, thirsty. These dreamless spells are like death to me, or enchantment, blank, outside time. One evening, rubbing her scalp with oil, massaging her temples and forehead, I notice in the corner of one eye a grayish puckering, as though a caterpillar lay there with its head under her eyelid, grazing. "What is this?" I ask, tracing the caterpillar with my fingernail.
"That is where they touched me," she says,
and pushed my hand away. "Does it hurt?" She shakes her head. "Let me look." It has been growing more and more clear to me that until the marks on this girl's body are deciphered and understood, I cannot let go of her. Between thumb and forefinger, I part her eyelids. The caterpillar comes to an end, decapitated, at the pink inner rim of the eyelid. There is no other mark. The eye is whole. I look into the eye. Am I to believe that gazing back at me, she sees nothing? My feet, perhaps, parts of the room, a hazy circle of light, but at the center where I am, only a blur, a blank. I pass my hand slowly in front of her face, watching her pupils. I cannot discern any movement. She does not blink, but she smiles.
"Why? Do you do that? Do you think I cannot see?"
Brown eyes, so brown as to be black. I touch my lips to her forehead.
"What did they do to you?"
I murmur. My tongue is slow. I sway on my feet with exhaustion.
"Why don't you want to tell me?"
She shakes her head. On the edge of oblivion, it comes back to me that my fingers running over her buttocks have felt a phantom crisscross of ridges under the skin. Nothing is worse than what we can imagine, I mumble. She gives no sign that she has even heard me. I slump on the couch, drawing her down beside me, yawning. Tell me, I want to say. Don't make a mystery of it. Pain is only pain. But words elude me. My arm folds around her. My lips are at the hollow of her ear. I struggle to speak. Then blackness falls. I have relieved her of the shame of begging and installed her in the barracks kitchen as a scullery maid. From the kitchen to the magistrate's bed in 16 easy steps. That is how the soldiers talk of the kitchen maids. Another of their sayings, what is the last thing the magistrate does when he leaves in the morning? He shuts his latest girl in the oven. The smaller a town, the more richly it hums with gossip. There are no private affairs here. Gossip is the air we breathe. For part of the day she washes dishes, peels vegetables, helps to bake bread and prepare the humdrum round of porridge, soup and stew that the soldiers are fed. There are, besides her, the old lady who has ruled over the kitchen almost as long as I have been magistrate, and two girls, the younger of whom ascended the 16 stairs once or twice last year. At first, I am afraid these two will band together against her, but no, they seem quickly to make friends. Passing the kitchen door on my way out, I hear, muffled by the steamy warmth, voices. Soft chatter, giggles. I am amused to detect in myself the faintest stab of jealousy. Do you mind the work? I ask her.
I like the other girls. They are nice.
At least it's better than begging, isn't it?
Yes.
The three girls sleep together in a small room a few doors from the kitchen. If they do not happen to be sleeping elsewhere. It is to this room that she finds her way in the dark, if I send her away in the night or the early morning. No doubt her friends have prattled about these trysts of hers, and the details are all over the marketplace. The older a man, the more grotesque people find his couplings, like the spasms of a dying animal. I cannot play the part of a man of iron, or a saintly widower. Sniggers, jokes, knowing looks. These are part of the price I am resigned to pay. Do you like it, living in a town? I ask her cautiously.
I like it most of the time. There is more to do.
Are there things you miss?
I miss my sister.
If you really want to go back, I say, I will have you taken.
Taken where?
She says. She lies on her back with her hands placidly over her breasts. I lie beside her, speaking softly. This is where the break always falls. This is where my hand caressing her belly seems as awkward as a lobster. The erotic impulse, if that is what it has been, withers. With surprise, I see myself clutched to this stolid girl, unable to remember what I ever desired in her, angry with myself for wanting and not wanting her. She herself is oblivious of my swings of mood. Her days have begun to settle into a routine with which she seems content. In the morning, after I have left, she comes to sweep and dust the apartment. Then she helps in the kitchen with the midday meal. Her afternoons are mainly her own. After the evening meal, after all the pots and pans have been scoured, the floor washed, the fire damped, she leaves her fellows and picks her way up the stairs to me. She undresses and lies down, waiting for my inexplicable attentions. Perhaps I sit beside her, stroking her body, waiting for a flush of blood that never truly comes. Perhaps I simply blow out the lamp and settle down with her. In the dark, she soon forgets me and falls asleep. So I lie beside this healthy young body while it knits itself in sleep into ever sturdier health. Working in silence, even at the points of irremediable damage, the eyes, the feet, to be whole again. I cast my mind back, trying to recover an image of her as she was before. I must believe that I saw her on the day she was brought in by the soldiers, roped neck to neck with the other barbarian prisoners. I know that my gaze must have passed over her when, together with the others, she sat in the barracks yard waiting for whatever was to happen next. My eye passed over her, but I have no memory of that passage. On that day she was still unmarked. But I must believe she was unmarked, as I must believe she was once a child. A little girl in pigtails, running after her pet lamb in a universe where somewhere far away I strode in the pride of my life. Strain as I will, my first image remains of the kneeling beggar girl. I have not entered her. From the beginning, my desire has not taken on that direction, that directedness. Lodging my dry old man's member in that blood-hot sheath makes me think of acid in milk, ashes in honey, chalk in bread. When I look at her naked body and my own, I find it impossible to believe that once upon a time I imagined the human form as a flower radiating out from a kernel in the loins. These bodies of hers and mine are diffuse, gaseous, centerless, at one moment spinning about a vortex here, at another curdling, thickening elsewhere, but often also flat, blank. I know what to do with her no more than one cloud in the sky knows what to do with another. I watch her as she undresses, hoping to capture in her movements a hint of an old free state. But even the motion with which she pulls the smock up over her head and throws it aside is crabbed, defensive, trammelled, as though she were afraid of striking unseen obstacles. Her face has the look of something that knows itself watched. From a trapper I have bought a little silver fox cub. It is no more than a few months old, barely weaned, with teeth like a fine saw edge. The first day she took it with her to the kitchen, but it was terrified by the fire and the noise, so now I keep it upstairs where it cowers all day under the furniture. During the night, I sometimes hear the click-click of its claws on the wooden floors as it roams about. It laps from a saucer of milk and eats scraps of cooked meat. It cannot be house-trained. The rooms have begun to smell of its droppings. But it is still too early to let it run loose in the yard. Every few days I call in the cook's grandson to crawl behind the cabinet and under the chairs to clean up the mess. "It's a very pretty little creature," I say. She shrugs.
"Animals belong outdoors."
"Do you want me to take it to the lake and let it go?"
"You can't do that. It is too young. It would starve to death, or dogs would catch it."
So the fox cub stays. Sometimes I see its sharp snout peeking out from a dark corner. Otherwise, it is only a noise in the night, and a pervasive tang of urine as I wait for it to grow big enough to be disposed of. People will say I keep two wild animals in my rooms, a fox and a girl. She does not see the joke, or does not like it. Her lips close, her gaze settles rigidly on the wall. I know she is doing her best to glare at me. My heart goes out to her. But what can I do? Whether I appear to her decked in my robes of office, or whether I stand naked before her, or whether I tear open my breast for her, I am the same man. I am sorry, I say, the words falling inertly from my mouth. I reach out 5 doe fingers and stroke her hair. Of course, it is not the same. One after another, I interview those men who were on duty while the prisoners were being questioned. From each, I get the same account. They hardly spoke to the prisoners. They were not permitted to enter the room where the interrogations took place. They cannot tell me what went on in there. But from the sweeping woman, I get a description of the room itself.
Just a little table and stools. 3 stools. And a mat in the corner, otherwise quite bare.
No
fire, only a brazier. I used to empty out the ashes.
Now that life has returned to normal, the room is in use again. At my request, the 4 soldiers who were quartered there dragged their chests out onto the gallery, piled their sleeping mats, plates, and mugs on top of them, take down their strings of laundry. I close the door and stand in the empty room. The air is still and cold. Already the lake is beginning to freeze over. The first snows have fallen. Far away, I hear the bells of a pony cart. I close my eyes and make an effort to imagine the room as it must have been 2 months ago during the colonel's visit. But it is difficult to lose myself in reverie with the 4 young men dawdling outside, chafing their hands together, stamping their feet, murmuring, impatient for me to go, their warm breath forming puffs in the air. I kneel down to examine the floor. It is clean. It is swept daily. It is like the floor of any room. Above the fireplace on the wall and ceiling, there is soot. There is also a mark the size of my hand where soot has been rubbed into the wall. Otherwise, the walls are blank. What signs can I be looking for? I open the door and motion to the men to bring their belongings back. A second time, I interview the 2 guards who were on duty in the yard. Tell me exactly what happened when prisoners were questioned. Tell me what you yourselves saw. The taller one replies, a boy with a long jaw and an eager air whom I have always liked.
The officer...
The police officer?
Yes, the police officer would come to the hall where the prisoners were kept, and he would point. We would fetch the prisoners he wanted and take them out to be questioned. Afterwards, we would take them back.
One at a time?
Not always. Sometimes 2.
You know that one of the prisoners afterwards died. Do you remember that prisoner? Do you know what they did to him?
We heard he went berserk and attacked them.
Yes?
That is what we heard. I helped to carry him back to the hall, where they all slept. He was breathing strangely. Very deep and fast. That was the last I saw of him. He was dead the next day.
Go on. I am listening. I want you to tell me everything you can remember. The boy's face is strained. I am sure he has been advised not to talk.
That man was questioned longer than anyone else. I saw him sitting by himself in a corner. After he'd been in the first time, holding his head.
His eyes flicker towards his companion.
He would not eat anything. He was not hungry. His daughter was with him. She tried to make him take food, but he would not.
What happened to his daughter?
She was also questioned, but not so long.
Go on. But he has nothing more to tell me. Listen, I say. We both know who the daughter is. She is the girl who stays with me. It is not a secret. Now go on, tell me what happened.
I do not know, sir. Most of the time, I was not there.
He appeals to his friend, but his friend is mute.
Sometimes there was screaming. I think they beat her, but I was not there. When I came off duty, I would go away.
You know that today she cannot walk. They broke her feet. Did they do these things to her in front of the other man, her father?
Yes, I think so.
And you know that she cannot see properly anymore. When did they do that?
Sir, there were many prisoners to take care of, some of them sick. I knew that her feet were broken, but I knew nothing about her being blind too long afterwards. There was nothing I could do. I did not want to become involved in a matter I did not understand.
His friend has nothing to add. I dismiss them. Do not be afraid because you have spoken to me, I say. In the night, the dream comes back. I am trudging across the snow of an endless plain towards a group of tiny figures playing around a snow castle. As I approach, the children sidle away or melt into the air. Only one figure remains, a hooded child sitting with its back to me. I circle around the child, who continues to pat snow on the sides of the castle, till I can peer under the hood. The face I see is blank, featureless. It is the face of an embryo or a tiny whale. It is not a face at all, but another part of the human body that bulges under the skin. It is white. It is the snow itself. Between numb fingers, I hold out a coin. Winter has settled in. The wind blows from the north and will blow incessantly for the next 4 months. Standing at the window with my forehead against the cold glass, I hear it whistle in the eaves, lifting and dropping a loose roof tile. Flurries of dust chase across the square. Dust patters against the pane. The sky is full of fine dust. The sun swims up into an orange sky and sets, copper red. Now and again there are squalls of snow which briefly fleck the earth with white. The siege of winter is on. The fields are empty. No one has reason to go outside the town walls, except those few who make a livelihood by hunting. The twice-weekly parade of the garrison has been suspended. The soldiers have permission to quit the barracks if they wish and live in the town, for there is little for them to do but drink and sleep. When I walk the ramparts in the early morning, half the watchposts are empty, and the numbed sentries on duty, swathed in furs, struggle to raise a hand in salute. They might as well be in their beds. For the duration of the winter, the Empire is safe. Beyond the eyes reach the barbarians too, huddled about their stoves, are gritting their teeth against the cold. There have been no barbarian visitors this year. It used to be that groups of nomads would visit the settlement in winter to pitch their tents outside the walls and engage in barter, exchanging wool, skins, felts, and leatherwork for cotton goods, tea, sugar, beans, flour. We prize barbarian leatherwork, particularly the sturdy boots they sew. In the past, I have encouraged commerce, but forbidden payment in money. I have also tried to keep the taverns closed to them. Above all, I do not want to see a parasite settlement grow up on the fringes of the town, populated with beggars and vagrants, enslaved to strong drink. It always pained me in the old days to see these people fall victim to the guile of shopkeepers, exchanging their goods for trinkets, lying drunk in the gutter, and confirming thereby the settlers' litany of prejudice, that barbarians are lazy, immoral, filthy, stupid. Where civilization entailed the corruption of barbarian virtues and the creation of a dependent people, I decided, I was opposed to civilization. And upon this resolution I base the conduct of my administration. I say this, who now keep a barbarian girl for my bed. But this year a curtain has fallen all along the frontier. From our ramparts we stare out over the wastes. For all we know, keener eyes than ours stare back. Commerce is at an end. Since the news arrived from the capital that whatever might be necessary to safeguard the empire would be done, regardless of cost, we have returned to an age of raids and armed vigilance. There is nothing to do but keep our swords bright, watch and wait. I spend my time in my old recreations. I read the classics. I continue to catalogue my various collections. I collate what maps we have of the southern desert region. On days when the wind does not bite so keenly, I take out a party of diggers to clear drift sand from the excavations. And once or twice a week I set off by myself in the early morning to hunt antelope along the lakeshore. A generation ago there were antelope and hares, in such numbers that watchmen with dogs had to patrol the fields by night to protect the young wheat. But under pressure from the settlement, particularly from dogs running wild and hunting in packs, the antelope have retreated eastward and northward to the lower reaches of the river and the far shore. Now the hunter must be prepared to ride at least an hour before he can begin his stalk. Sometimes, on a good morning, I am enabled to live again all the strength and swiftness of my manhood. Like a wraith, I glide from brake to brake. Shod in boots that have soaked in 30 years of grease, I wade through icy water. Over my coat I wear my huge old bearskin. Rime forms on my beard, but my fingers are warm in their mittens. My eyes are sharp, my hearing is keen, I sniff the air like a hound, I feel a pure exhilaration. Today, I leave my horse hobbled where the line of marsh grass ends on the bleak southwest shore and begin to push my way through the reeds. The wind blows chill and dry straight into my eyes. The sun is suspended like an orange on a horizon streaked black and purple. Almost at once, with absurd good fortune, I come upon a waterbuck, a ram with heavy curved horns, shaggy in his winter coat, standing sideways onto me, teetering as he stretches up for the reed tips. From not 30 paces, I see the placid circular motion of his jaw, hear the splash of his hooves. Around his fetlocks I can make out circlets of ice drops.